How's it going?
Good, good. How you doing, Joe?
Fine, fine. So, as we were chatting before, it's good to finally meet. We see each other all the time on emails, and I think on our friends' calls, but we've actually never had a chance to I think be one on one. So it's good to finally catch up.
Yeah,
So,
same here.
yeah, I guess for people who don't know who you are, do you want to give a quick intro?
Sure. Yeah. Well, thanks for inviting me on the show.
Anytime.
My name is Steve Hoberman, and I've been in the data field for forever, actually, since 1990. I started with Bell Labs in New Jersey.
Wow.
And it was kind of interesting because they offered me one of three different positions. One position was a network engineer, where I'd be actually working on some of the phone equipment and designing it. And the second was a developer. So at the time, the programming language of choice was C. So I'd become a C programmer. And the third was, and it had the shortest job description. It was like a 3 or 4 sentence job description. It said, "We need you to help redesign our business." Like, that sounds really cool. So I joined that team and we built data models. We actually built data models for the whole phone industry. It was a wonderful project. And I was there for a number of years. Then I went to work on Wall Street for a few years as a modeler, and then M&M Mars Candy. I was actually at M&M Mars for about 10 years.
Wow.
And yeah, then wrote my first book on data modeling when I was there, and then decided to write a second book. And that's I decided instead of just writing the book, why can't I just do everything else and publish it? So I published my
Yeah.
second book myself. And since then, we've published over 150 books on data, including the DM Bok and works by Bill Inman and some other leaders in the field. So it's been a good ride.
Yeah, and it's crazy to get your history in a bit, but I just got to say, like, your books I consider to be the best books on data consistently. I think Techniques is, I think it's definitely just a gold mine of books. So thanks for that. Like every book I've seen is like just it's good. It's or
Yeah.
great. And so
Thank you.
that's
Thank
really
you very much.
cool.
I think part of it is I only publish books that I want to read. And so I'm looking very carefully. I'm thinking, okay, if I was a reader, would this book be of interest? And then I'm a critical reader when I get the manuscript. So I like to do a lot of the editing and provide feedback to the authors. So thank you for that. That's good to hear.
Yeah, we'll get more into that in a second because I want to expand on the book. But rewinding though, back to the 90s and your experience in data modeling, walk me through this. At the time, like, what was the state of data modeling, or did it really exist back then as a formal practice?
Yeah, it's really interesting. Data modeling was really, really hot in the 80s up through the mid 90s. There was this huge effort called information engineering that was kind of taking hold in many large organizations. And it was all about getting the big picture of your organization. So taking a step back and thinking, okay, what is a customer? What is a product? What is an account? And then figuring out how all these pieces connect. And then redesigning all of your applications to match this picture. So actually, data modeling was that was probably the heyday of a lot of data mod. There were actually data modeling organizations everywhere. There was a lot of formal training in data modeling. That was kind of the hot period. It's still hot today, very hot today, but it's very different today than it was back then because data modeling was driving a lot of things. And then probably in the mid 90s, you had client server. And Ralph Kimball and his dimensional modeling. So it took more of a application focus instead of this big picture focus. And then in the early 2000s, you had Agile, and that continued to make it more of a project specific technique instead of more of a program. And then the pendulum swung the other way in like the mid 2000s, and kind of goes back and forth depending on what's happening with the technology. Things like the data mesh make data modeling more important, so it's kind of going back in that way. Things like AI is making data modeling more important, so it's kind of going back that way. So you kind of see the pendulum swinging. If you've been in the industry, like I've been data modeling for over 35 years, you kind of see it go back and forth, back and forth. If data modeling is not in vogue today, it will be a few years from now. So save your bell-bottom jeans. They will come back in style really soon.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah, it's something I've always wondered about too, because the pendulum definitely does swing, and it's interesting getting your perspective on this and sort of these chronological events, because I think this is it's lining up with what I had researched as well. Because the biggest question was why, and I asked Bill this, Bill Inman, I was like, why do we keep asking the same types of questions in the data field over and over again? You'd think that we'd be moving past, like, how do I know what a customer is, or how do I know what an account is? Like, this seems like it would be a solved problem, but it and it seems like with the latest crop of data tooling, like everything is super easy to do, but yet we still come back to the same questions. And what I personally realized, and I'd love your take on this, is the data modeling, at least today, feels somewhat like a lost art, right? I think, as you point out, with Agile and everything, it became very project specific, and we lost context of the bigger picture. It seems now we're maybe starting to have those discussions again, but exactly. It's interesting. Yeah,
it is really interesting. You know, so I'm no longer an employee of a company. I do a lot of consulting and I do a lot of training. So I get to see organizations, usually when there is a project they're working on and they need to train their staff on why data modeling is so important, or when they're in the middle of a project and something's not going quite right and they need a little bit of help there. So my perspective is kind of one where I kind of see it more in a, mostly in a reactive mode, where there's certain challenges. And like you said, it's asking the same question. So what is a customer? We didn't answer it completely a few years ago. And even with all the greatest technology, I mean, even AI can't tell us who our customer really is. I mean, it can phrase things in a nice way and make us and present something in a confident with confidence, but it's not necessarily our definition of customer. So a lot of it comes down to hard work, actually, and trying to figure out what the terms mean. And it's interesting you started with that one, Joe, because that is the most of my current assignments are at that higher level. It used to be called the conceptual level, like coming up with that high level model that shows how everything connects together. That's really where the gold mine is for a lot of organizations, is to take a step back and think about, okay, what's our vocabulary? How can we get our teams who are working on this great technology to actually talk the same language? When they're using the word customer, everybody knows what a customer means. When they're using the word product, everybody knows what a product means. And so, I mean, one of the ways I try to redefine myself and look at the field differently every couple of years. And my latest transformation is going from conceptual, logical, physical, which we've been using since the 70s, to align, refine, design. So align is all about aligning on a common vocabulary. And then refine is all about refining on a set of common requirements. And then design is all about making it real, building that powerful database layer. So I think a lot of what's in vogue right now is kind of taking the technology that's out there and not trying to fit it to traditional modeling, but taking traditional modeling and trying to make it work with what's out there. And I think a starting point was redefining what we do into align, refine, design.
What was that realization? Why not just stick with the common framework of conceptual, logical, and physical?
It's fascinating too, because so it was about 4 years ago, and an organization, a very large financial company, asked me to teach a class. I do a lot of data modeling courses. I have a 5-day data modeling class. I've been teaching it since 1992, actually, in different variations. And this large financial company said they want to train their employees on data modeling, but the audience, they're not data modelers. They'll never do data modeling. They are NoSQL developers. They work, they're working with DynamoDB, a NoSQL database, and they wanted me to train them. So they didn't want to hear words like conceptual, logical, physical.
Right.
They felt that that was all kind of trying to fit kind of the square peg in the round hole kind of thing. They wanted to know, how can data modeling help them as DynamoDB developers? So my first structuring of the course material was, what do I call this stuff? I mean, what do I name it so that they don't tune out and so that it connects to what they're doing? So I was looking at it more in terms of function. Conceptual, logical, physical doesn't really come across as a function. Conceptual sounds like something optional, an ivory tower. Logical seems like, you know, Star Trek and Dr. Spock. And physical seems like, you know, 50 Shades of Grey. So you kind of want to come up with terms that really resonate with the audience. So I was thinking more about a line refined design, and that class went over really well. And I think a lot of it was rethinking what we do, taking our, not changing, but taking what we've been doing for 40 years and just renaming it, maybe talking more about its purpose rather than come up with a name like conceptual logical physical.
I really like that. Really like that a lot. That's, and so when you're talking to, say, NoSQL developers, right? Because you're talking about developers, you're not talking about data people per se whose job is to focus on the wider enterprise and come up with analytics. I mean, these people are working probably in sprints and they have very discrete features they have to ship and so forth. Yeah. I mean, how do you, especially for the align and refine part, how do you convey the importance and I guess make it become a practice with teams that are very agile focused? Because he seems, because the pushback I always get if I mention things like conceptual modeling to teams is like, that's cute. I don't have time for this. I have 2 weeks to get features done. Exactly. I don't really have time to think about anything. Yeah. I'm hyped up on Red Bull trying to push out these features. How does that work?
You know, I use a number of different techniques, and the one I used not too long ago for probably one of the largest financial companies in the world, a different one than the one I was teaching this DynamoDB class for, is I walk into the room instead of talking about what, and this was a meeting with executives to explain why data modeling is important, and I really had to convince them, is I actually gave them a quiz. I asked them to write down, this was for an HR system, and I asked them to write down their definition for an employee. And there were maybe, 15, 18 people around the table. These are human resource executives. I asked them to write down their definition for an employee and a few other things. And then I asked them to make sure everyone in the room had the same definition. And as I expected, they had very different views of what an employee was. And this was a company that was getting ready to spend, I would say, $60 to $70 million on an HR system.
Wow.
How can they deliver an HR system successfully about employees if they have very different views of what an employee is? That's kind of setting themselves up for a failed application. So I like to do things like that. I like to make it more of a game or a quiz and just kind of see. And sometimes, you know what, maybe everyone sees a certain term the same way, and that's a great thing, but it doesn't happen often. Yeah.
Where do you think that starts?
Yeah.
Because I've noticed that vocabulary and data has something of an entropy to it. It starts and it works, and then over time, things sort of drift and decay and sort of turn into other things.
That's a great way to look at it too. And that's actually really what happens. It's, you know what I think it is? And when you were mentioning earlier about Agile, it really is that Agile is very much project focused and deliverable focused. And usually the whole idea of maintenance and the bigger picture takes a back seat. Yeah. And so what happens is, even if you get these really motivated individuals and they focus in their environment on coming up with a perfect align, refine, design set of structures, things change. And maybe 6 months after the project goes live, this organization sells part of their business, or they buy a part of their business, or they just look at their business a little bit differently. If we don't go back and revisit what we did with the align, refine, design, we slowly forget it's there, and it starts losing value because it's no longer reflecting a current view. So yeah, you see, entropy is probably a really, and that would be, see, Joe, you're speaking at our data modeling zone conference coming up in Phoenix.
Yeah, stoked on that. Yeah.
And I think a data modeling entropy, boy, that would be a great topic right there.
I'll make a note on that.
Yeah, because that's really what happens. And it's really frustrating, because there was even one organization that I was brought in as a consultant. And then about 5-6 years later, I was brought in again to the same company, different team. Mm-hmm. But it was revisiting the same issues that we fixed the first time. So it kind of, there needs to be something in place. And I'm not sure whether it's tool-based or process-based or something that once you do it right, that you keep it there, not easy to do.
It's an interesting one. Like I was talking to a really big company in India about this, and I was going to talk on data modeling in Bangalore, which is you know, if the audience knows Bangalore, it's sort of the, I consider it actually more of the Silicon Valley of the world than Silicon Valley itself. It's where it's a manufacturing hub. It's where all the software is written.
Yes.
Like down to it. There's, I think the old joke was you could throw a stone and you'll either hit the sidewalk or you hit a software engineer walking down the street. But the question came up. So I was like, okay, so I mean, because I think when you mentioned the words data modeling to people, the first thing, especially if they're from the analytics world, they think, oh, Kimball, star schemas. Like that's sort of what the equation is. And I was like, well, but if you tie it back to the broader concepts of your business and the vocabulary you use, what would you call that? And like, well, I don't know. We don't really think about things in that term. But I was like, well, so walk me through some of the problems that you have in your business. And the entropy thing coming up, you know, terms drift, data sort of doesn't match the business reality anymore. So one thing I sort of advise yourself off the cuff is like, well, maybe just do a conceptual audit. I don't know, call it whatever you will, but maybe for the important things that you're in your data model, just make sure it at least matches with whatever the business is supposed to be doing. I didn't offer any recommendations because again, it was just sort of an off the cuff thing. I was like, I don't know, maybe that'll work. But these approaches seem almost antithetical because you're talking like, especially when you get to areas of conceptual modeling, you're starting to cross over into areas of, you know, information sciences and even philosophy in some sense. And so I think people start equating the higher level thinking with this abstract notion of now we're going to get into sort of this navel gazing exercise of, you know, not shipping features and focusing on, you know, vocabulary and semantics. And like this, people don't want to touch that. I don't think so.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, that's one of the reasons too. I do not like the word conceptual. Conceptual sounds just like that. It's like, okay, you know, we have extra time. Let's talk about life and data modeling. Right. And it's really about aligning to a common vocabulary. So, and it's interesting about the audit idea. So about 20 years ago, I started assessing models, and I came up with my own technique called the data model scorecard, which is instead of 10 criteria that I use to assess a model. And so what some organizations do is they actually use that, and maybe ever so often they'll just kind of review their models and see how they're doing. But it's still I've gotten very good feedback on it, but I'd love something more proactive where it's part of the process. You know, it's just like you do agile, and at the end of an agile sprint you might have some kind of meeting to see what went well and what could have gone better. Something in that meeting that says, okay, you did pretty good in your coding. Now let's look at your model and let's assess it with a scorecard. And so I'd love something like that to take hold in the organizations.
But actually it's interesting with the rise of large language models, you think that might be maybe a technical assist to that?
It could be. Yeah, it really could be. Because actually, a lot of what I teach in my classes is coming up with templates and questions to ask to complete each of the align, refine, design levels. And a lot of that could be done in an LLM. In fact, I'm making a note here. Maybe I could play around with that. I'm actually meeting with a NoSQL expert later this week who's going to show me what he's been using LLMs for in NoSQL.
So cool.
It's got to be eventually something in that space, which actually kind of scares me, because then what happens to us modelers when you have, Hal answering all the questions?
I think it scales it is what happens. I mean, you provide it with the right inputs and maybe, but because I've been thinking about a lot about this too. I think that the problems of data management, for example, right? If you go through the Daemon Book of Knowledge, it's huge, a lot to know. And data management is one of these fields where, I mean, I speak at Daemon conferences and events, and it feels like it's a lot of it. Again, it's the same issues we've been talking about for decades, right? Mm-hmm. And I wrote an article. I felt like as data keeps growing, right, especially now that you have AI generated data, this is a new thing that didn't exist before, right? Yeah. And I think 95% of the data on the internet is supposed to be AI generated by next year. That's crazy.
Wow. I did not hear that. That's incredible.
Yeah. And you start thinking, start applying that to enterprises, and now data is going to grow at such a volume that the only way to handle this is through something that's automated. Humans will not be able to do this.
Yeah.
I don't know what the consequences of that are, but you know,
it's
fascinating.
That changes all three levels, align, refine, design. Cause as we create more data, then, well, maybe even the definition of a customer changes. So it really needs to go through the whole stack. Yeah. Really something.
Yeah. Really it's something. Fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it is. I mean, I was consulting with a sports company maybe 6-7 years ago. This is before open AI and everything. And I was talking about what questions to ask to build your logical, that refined stage. And someone in the room built a chat bot that answered all the questions. And I'm like, wow, in a few years from now, this is going to be really credible. And I'm like, okay, we're here now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really something. Maybe the maintenance of it, though, comes back to you're starting to see knowledge graphs come back into vogue too with the rise of LLMs, because I think the combination of large language models and knowledge graphs, the two together, is what's really helping step over the hallucination effect. Who was it? One Cicada from Data.World and his team did some really good research on the hallucinations, like text to SQL. And so text to SQL on its own using a large language model is pretty bad, actually. Like, I think the results were usually terrible at best to like absolutely useless and dangerous at worst. Especially as you get more joins, it's just, the types of questions it tries to answer are just all over the place. But knowledge graphs appear to at least alleviate much of the hallucination effects. So, but knowledge graphs are also very difficult to put together sometimes. So
yeah that's true.
Maybe that's what thought models do. I don't know.
In fact, that, speaking about how data modeling is in vogue and then it's not, and then it's in, I actually see knowledge graphs as kind of the, an area that will make modeling in vogue for quite a few years to come. And that actually, just going back to the conference, and you're speaking at Data Modeling Zone as well later in February, we have a whole track on knowledge graphs and semantic technologies just for that reason, because the same skills you use to build traditional models transfer perfectly into the world of graphs and knowledge graphs and so on. So it's really... it's really different. It might be different symbols. It might be looking at the world in terms of instances instead of structures, but the same skills we use and the same steps of align, refine, design transfer perfectly. So, I mean, I see that as kind of, if you are a data modeler and you're kind of listening to this chat, learning more about knowledge graphs is really to your advantage because your skills will transfer perfectly. Yeah. Really something.
It is really something. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know where this goes. Honestly, I've been thinking a lot about this, and I don't have any clear answers yet. It just seems like everything's playing out in real time, and especially in generative AI, it seems like there's a revolutionary new white paper every couple of days that comes out, and so I don't know.
I know what you mean, but you know what it is? It's like you have all these amazing things that come out, but then you also have a traditional way of doing application development. And, and I think there's still that gap there, at least for a while. We're trying to figure out, okay, how does this all fit together? It's not coming together. I know even for my own publishing company, I every day I wake up thinking, okay, how can I use AI to sell more books? And I talk to our authors, many of who are kind of leaders in the space and also some in the world of AI, and it's not coming together yet. I tried something really cool with this. They have these generative AI chatbots where you can actually load a PDF file and then answer questions against it. And I've been playing around with about 10 different vendors who do this sort of thing. And I'm having this really frustrating experience because I uploaded a book and I chose one of my books that actually did not sell well. I wrote a book on blockchain when blockchain was in vogue. And I started asking these chatbots, okay, so what is blockchain? And they would answer it well. And then I would ask questions like, well, can you recommend a book on blockchain? And it kept recommending one of my competitors' books on blockchain. I'm like, stop doing that. My book is better. That was just one example. But I was kind of yelling at these chatbots. And they started thinking, what is this going to be used for anyway? Is someone going to query the chatbot instead of buy the book? Or are they going to query the chatbot and then it's going to whet their appetites to go buy the book? So
it's an interesting question. I mean, I published a book with O'Reilly and I noticed they launched a feature on their site where it's a large language model interface, right? Okay. So I guess you can introspect all the books. I mean, as an author, other authors, the first question was, okay, so how do we get comp for this? The content, right? Cause it's an interesting question. I thought it was an interesting use case, but I don't know. I think for people to use the chatbot as the interface to find out answers, I think there needs to be trust that the hallucination effect has been overcome, right? I think generative AI is awesome for generating stuff like images and I think content like that, where you don't really care if it's right or not. It just looks cool and it saves you a ton of time. I use ChatGPT and Bard on a daily basis, just more as a friend to chat with, like, let's talk about this topic, you know, and it does a really good job at coming up with just stuff out of left field. It's like, holy crap. Like those are interesting ideas I would never have thought of. Cause you get caught in your bubble, right? And it helps throw you into other things. But as far as writing content, I mean, I know my book has, if I go on Amazon, there's several knockoffs with the same title. And if you download the Kindle samples, they're all ChatGPT written. You can tell, like, this is not human. They suck. So
yeah, and it's really frustrating because you can spend a couple of weeks kind of proving to organizations like Amazon, yeah, like, I am the copyright holder and you need to take this down. And by the time you do this, three more up there. So
yeah. And what was it? Amazon, I think a couple months ago, they said authors can't publish more than 3 books per day now.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Wow.
You can see where this goes.
Yeah. Yeah, I know as a publisher, whenever I list a new book with Amazon, they have another section I have to complete now about AI, and it asks questions like, did you use AI to write any parts of your book? And so they're trying to catch a lot of these that are out there. But yeah, it's pretty frustrating because since we started publishing books, it's been about 20 years too, and it was kind of easy in the beginning to find a rogue copy out there and get it off. And if we could get it off, we could at least tell Google, take it out of your search engine. But now it's a different playing field.
Where do you think it takes publishing?
Which one? I'm sorry.
Sorry. Where do you think AI takes publishing?
I actually don't. No, it's kind of interesting because I publish books. I published over 150 books, and they all deal with data. AI is all about data, but I don't know the answer to that question yet. And maybe taking small steps. So, for example, one way it's going to impact is help authors write better books. So I was working with an author a few weeks ago. English was not their first language. And so what they would do is they would get their ideas down and they would use a large language model to put it in a better phrase, make it edit a little bit better, you know, make it sound better. And I cautioned the author. I said, you don't want to use that. Let us do the editing this cycle, because so the answer is not really a technology answer. It's really more of a legal, maybe government, maybe regulatory answer is what's going to be allowed. I would not want to have part of our book be generated by AI and then we get sued because it's based on someone else's content, or people start looking at Technics publications and going, wait a minute, they just wrote a book with AI. We start to lose credibility. We have very high credibility in the industry. And so I'm very careful with how we use it. Right now, I just want to write about it. I don't want it to impact our business directly.
Yeah, it's a mess right now.
It's really a mess. It's interesting what O'Reilly does with your book, that they have that front end you can kind of query. So they do have that kind of ability now with your book, where you can kind of ask questions.
And a lot of people's books. Yeah, I mean, it was just kind of, tell me about data engineering, and we're like, oh, it's interesting, or whatever topic. Yeah, I mean, as an author, it's interesting because you. I talked to an IP lawyer and they said, okay, so like if something's AI generated, it's not copyrightable. Right. So there's that. Mm-hmm. So if you have a whole book that's written with ChatGPT, that's nice, except it ain't actually yours. So
that's right. That's right. But you could still get sued over it in today's legal environment. Right. I mean, mm-hmm. so you're attaching your name to it. So there is that legal part of it. You're saying you are the author. So it's kind of this gray area. If I was back in school, I would become a lawyer and specialize in AI, and that would probably be pretty good field.
That's one career field I'm trying to get my kid into. He's 13. Yeah, he likes to argue a lot. So I mean, you'd be a perfect litigator. You should get into this. So he's doing it. That's his goal, is to become a lawyer right now. He's 13. Who knows what will happen? But I'm like, you're gonna be a good lawyer if you keep this up. So.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, you see, those are the skills you need right there. And especially with him having you as a dad, you know, you can help kind of, you can steer him a little bit more to technology.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, I was having coffee yesterday with a friend. A famous NFL athlete. I'll leave it at that. But he's getting into AI right now and has a company. And it was interesting. Just, I think, you know, jamming on kind of stuff he's looking at. So it's about being able to have you know, people tell their stories and be able to generate, you know, cartoons and videos and stuff off of the stories, you know, kids and nice. Whatnot. I thought that was super cool.
Yeah.
But it feels like that's where it's all going, is just, you know, being able to create media on its own. And, you know, but the big thing he was talking about was like, how do you preserve the storyline, you know, through all this, you know, generated content, right?
Right. So
right. One.
Yeah. You're right about that. It's, and that's an area you mentioned earlier, you know, using it to generate images and graphics. I mean, that's a great use of AI.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Every blog post I do now, I just use DALL-E. It's just like, I could draw the image myself and it would take hours. That takes 5 seconds.
Wow. So there's a whole industry, though, the whole creative illustrative industry that's changing or disappearing, you know, something.
Yeah. That's interesting. Like, I mean, you've been in the data industry for a long time, and AI's and machine learning's come about numerous times. What do you feel is different about this time?
Yeah, I actually think it's about the interfaces. I think that we've always had the ability to store lots of data. It might have been more expensive 10, 20 years ago than it is today, but we always had that ability. And I think what's changed is the interface, where now you can actually ask a natural language kind of question and get back a natural language response. That to me is pretty fascinating, you know. And I think that it will continue to get more and more conversational, you know, where you're asking something and a difficult question, and the large language model says, certainly I can answer that question. Here is the answer, and I can do this and I can do that. So from my perspective, and I'm not an AI expert, my whole life is just data modeling, but I see the interface as being what's different. Because I took an AI class in college in 1988.
Wow.
It was all out there, and we talked about these sorts of things, but it's the ability to communicate with the tool that I think is really fascinating, because otherwise, you know, the masses could use it. It's not just people who are savvy with the technology.
So. Mm-hmm.
Which is scary.
Yeah, it is interesting. I feel like, I mean, I've worked in machine learning on and off for quite a while, and it feels like this is the big difference right now. You saw the consumerization of AI interfaces. I mean, you've kind of always had it with Siri on the phone, but that Siri's, you sort of know the boundaries and how to interface with it. It's not perfect by any means. It sucks actually pretty badly half the time. Alexa was the other one where it felt like that had a lot of hope as a conversational interface, but I mean, Alexa as a business unit, I think, like, loses a ton of money. I know that, you know, a startup I was at, we were working with Amazon on a Alexa for Business interface, and it just went nowhere. And so, but it feels like this is different, where, like, you can have a conversation, you know, you can create video, images, whatever
exactly.
You want.
Exactly. And then it's different. Really, you follow up questions. I mean, that's incredible.
Follow up questions. That's huge. Yeah.
Yeah. It really is something. So, we'll see where it's going. Really, it's an exciting time to be in technology, for sure.
Yeah, it is. It is. And kind of bringing it back, too. I mean, you're doing stuff like conferences that I don't think AI is going to be replacing anytime soon. I guess hold our beer and we'll find out. But why have you been doing conferences? It's a lot of work. When was your first conference?
Oh, we ran our first data modeling zone conference in Baltimore in 2012. And wow. Then, we brought in, it was data modelers from all over the world came to that one. And then, the following year we did it in the US and Europe. And then within a couple of years, we were running three a year, once in the US, once in Europe, usually Germany, and once in Australia. And the reason for it actually was to actually touch people, you know, in person. Those seemed like they were, things happened. There were sparks, there's excitement, and you can't get that yet staring at a screen. You know, we tried to do a virtual conference and it was very well organized and we had attendees, but it didn't have the spark you get when you're in an in-person event. So I do these events to catch up with friends and to learn and to network. I like to learn a lot too. And also just to meet people. I mean, we had one of our sponsors actually married one of our attendees at an event. You know, they met at one of our events and they got married. And so, you know, the interactions you get, I don't expect that at every conference, but I love the people part of it, you know, and hopefully that will never be replaced. I'm what I'm doing now is organizing evening events where people can go out for dinner every night and see each other and talk. And that's where a lot of the magic happens, I think.
It really does.
Yeah,
it really does. Like yesterday I was at CES in Vegas, and even though there are 130,000 people there or something, it was cool to catch up with, you know, people in person. You know, got a lot of friends there, and it's one thing to have a phone call, it's one thing to have emails, but it's entirely different thing just to go hang out and even just walk around, you know, look at all the booths and crazy stuff there. Yeah.
That's exactly right. You know, that hopefully won't get replaced anytime soon. I mean, we have some really cool sessions on AI, and we have sessions on knowledge graphs and a lot of sessions on data modeling. And we're bringing experts in from all over the world.
Oh yeah.
But it comes down to seeing people, talking to people, chatting in between sessions. I mean, that's where a lot of the magic happens.
So. Yeah, it really does. How do you go about finding speakers for events?
Yeah. So it's interesting. Well, we post kind of our call for speakers in different areas, but a lot of it is, I like to invite our authors to speak because I kind of know their topics and I've read their books. I also, I try to find problems that I'm having, similar to publishing, where I only publish books that I want to read and learn from. At the conferences, I'm thinking, okay, I really want to hear sessions that I don't know yet, or I want to learn myself. So that's something that I really am looking for. So those sorts of things, you know, anything that, you know, so for example, we have a whole track on new technologies, including AI, and that's something I'm not an expert in, but a few people coming are, and they're going to talk about it. And then knowledge graphs and your session, you know, your session, data modeling, is dead. I'm really curious about that. And I want to hear your perspective, you know, as the author of data engineering and kind of talking to lots of people in different industries, kind of how that fits. And so things like that, I find really fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, I found, you know, giving that talk around the world, it was really good. I learned a lot, I would say, right? Because I mean, you go to every basically geography on the planet except for South America, and I think you get a lot of varying perspectives. But you also see common themes, right? Yeah. And I think I would love to know, what are some of the common themes that you've seen, you know, throughout the conferences you've been holding? Are there any consistent themes that keep reappearing year after year?
Yeah. So definitely the importance of a big picture comes up at every event, including ours, actually. Like, you know, instead of just creating applications using Agile and building solutions really fast with NoSQL and having AI help wherever it could and getting these little siloed projects out there, something more foundational, you know, and it's gone by different names over the years. It used to be information engineering. It used to be a federated approach. It used to be called the data mesh, you know, so all about just connecting the dots, coming up with a big picture. That's always been a theme. It's gone by different names over the last 30 years, but that's something that's always been out there every talk, you know. And then there's always the, and it's funny because I'm just thinking about the different sessions we're having this year at DMZ to see how it fits that same mold. But
yeah,
So it's always about, you know, case studies and just what worked and what did not work. Those are always really fascinating to me. And, you know, I like to be in a room listening and think, okay, what's the next slide? Like, based on what I've seen over, because I've spoken at probably 70 to 80 conferences over the last 30 years. And just thinking, okay, what would be the next, what's the next slide going to look like? Is this person going to show this big picture slide showing the architecture, or is it going to be like, you know? So it's kind of interesting how a lot of things change, but there's certain principles that remain the same.
Yeah, there's certain principles. I think especially for giving talks, there's some things never go away, like being able to give a good talk, right? Like that's telling a good story. Like, I think that's here to stay. What do you think makes a good talk?
What makes a good talk? I would think that something that starts off with a problem that you're going to solve for the audience, you know, and you can kind of do this in a interactive way. And then you can make it more of a story than a lecture. So it's interesting. I was once asked to teach a data modeling class to some newly graduated college students who were joining a program at a bank to become IT people in the bank. And I started off with my typical data modeling lecture, and I realized that they are not listening. And I think people's attention spans are not what they were a few years ago. So I started thinking, okay, here's a problem we're going to solve, and let's take it step by step all the way through. And that approach works. So I think what makes a really good talk is to start off with a problem statement and show how you solve it. And you don't have to boil the ocean and show how everything fits together. But if people can leave the session with, oh, okay, I saw what the problem was, I know how to solve it myself, I mean, I think that makes a good talk. So me, myself, when I listen, I'm always trying to think, okay, did I learn at least one new thing during the talk? How about yourself? What do you think about that? Do you think it's more?
I highly agree. I can tell. I think the more the anti-patterns of a good talk, maybe what how you can make a bad talk is to not empathize with the audience, not meet people where they are. I think trying to show off how smart you are at the expense of providing useful information is like a cardinal sin, but it happens all the time. I think especially for more inexperienced speakers, it seems like there's a tendency to want to use it as sort of back in the 80s, you know, heavy metal artists did guitar solos a lot. And I feel like the guitar solo is one of these things where people just go up and just do that and not make the song. and these are not the same things. So
That's a good analogy. Yeah, I get that.
Well, it's just showing off at the end of the day. It's grandstanding. Yeah. And it's like, you know, people want actionable. Like you say, I like what you described as what's the next slide, right? It's a key to improv comedy. It's a yes and ... you know, it keeps the flow going. And I like what you said about when you did your course too, or your class, where you read the room and you course corrected immediately. You didn't just carry on saying, oh, well, I'm just going to keep teaching it and giving a lecture because that's what I know best, and screw these people, because if they can't figure it out, then whatever. It's like you had the EQ to figure out, okay, so let's course correct. And I think that's what makes a good talk, is being able to read the room and and refine it on the fly too. Like, I think a good speaker needs to be able to refine the talk to meet the audience on the fly, like not scripted, like, because that's a huge skill that you only get through, I think, knowing your subject matter to the point where you can empathize with the audience and being able to change it and simplify it to make it work.
Exactly. So, a lot of that's just, it comes with time. Like, oh, I wish I said this or that. Okay, I'll do that next time.
It's true. What about your courses, though? I mean, you've been teaching data modeling since it was a thing, basically. I guess I'll ask kind of the same question. What are some of the as you teach these courses and these classes, are there consistent themes that you've seen over the decades with people wanting to learn data modeling?
Yeah. So I've I started off in 1992, so maybe in the early mid 90s. The room was filled with people who wanted to be data modelers. They wanted to get into the data modeling career. And as that area And today, you know, you don't really have, you do still have data modeling teams, and that's great to see, but you often have people who are wearing multiple hats. So they're doing development and design, or they're doing business analysis and conceptual modeling, or the, you know, whatever you call that level. So I usually get people in the room who have really, really diverse backgrounds today. And I didn't get that in the beginning. It's kind of an interesting trend. Mm-hmm. I get people who need to know data modeling, but not necessarily be the data modeler. I get people who need to do data modeling as maybe 10, 20% of their job, but they're not, that's not their main goal. They have to deliver something bigger than just the data model. So I see that as something that's kind of been gradual, but it's more and more today. So I ask people to go around the room, even when I teach the classes through Zoom, and say, you know, tell me what you do. And it's, well, I'm an architect, but I also do some development, and I'm a business analyst, but I also do some modeling, you know? So you kind of see that more and more. I start off my class by saying, how do you define data modeling? And that's something that's been consistent. I see that year after year after year, where some people's definition has to do with building a solution. Okay, a data model is a picture of a database. And some people's definition has to do with communication, like a blueprint for a house. And there's always certain patterns I see. And that's something consistent that I see again and again and again. Yeah, it's really interesting.
I guess, you know, you say you revise your definitions every few years. Yeah. How would you define data modeling right now?
Yeah, so I see data modeling as a way to confirm and document our understanding of other people's perspectives. So I see it as a way to come up with a precise communication tool. So in my class, what I do is I build it up from different kinds of maps, like a map of the London tubes and a map of an org chart. So really, it's a precise diagram of an information landscape used to confirm and document our understanding of other people's perspectives. So the first is, I always use the word precise, because when you're looking at a data model, it can only be read only one way. You know, you and I can't look at the same model and read it differently. It's a precise language. And it shows how something should be. So for example, I often compare application development to a game of telephone. You know, when you're kids and you whisper something in somebody's ear and they whisper it to the person next to them. Yeah. By the time it gets to the other end of the room, it sounds completely different. That's how I see application development. I may whisper a requirement in your ear, and by the time it gets around the room, it sounds nothing like what I whispered in your ear. And so I talk about modeling being a way to get that game of telephone working really well, where you build this precise diagram, and by the time it works its way around the room, it's still what you said in the beginning. You know, so that's, and I you're getting me all excited now, and I'm thinking about my material, and I'm going to jump into fifth normal form in a minute, but I'll stop there.
So there's precision of definitions, but does that mean the data needs to be precise and correct?
The model needs to match either the way the data is or the way the data should be.
Yeah.
The data doesn't have to be precise and correct, as long as the model communicates what it is. You can have an awful application with really poor quality, and the model could show that. And that's useful, because you can say, here's the model of our current system, and there are issues. They're really, really big issues. And then you could also build a model for how it should be 3 years from now or 5 years from now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting, because I remember I asked Bill Inman what his true north was once, and he said it was believable data, I think was one of the things, right? And it's like, is that the same thing as correct or accurate? Mm. It's like, not really. It's because I mean, if you go to a lot of organizations, right, when's the last time you saw information or data that was like 100% correct?
Yeah, you're right. You know, I've never.
Right. I've never seen that either, right? I mean, maybe a financial institution, but even then, it's like, you know, the audits, I mean, there's certain degrees of being off.
Yeah. So, yeah, you're right. You're right. Yeah, I love that definition too, because it doesn't have to be perfect. Yeah, it has to be believable, has to be useful, has to be something you can make a decision based on.
Yeah. I like the precision thing, though. I never thought of it that way, where you have to have the data model needs to be precise in the way it describes
exactly
the flows. That's awesome. I'm gonna,
exactly. I'm actually teaching a 3-hour session at our conference on modeling, and that's one of the themes, is whatever we build got to be precise.
Has to be precise. What happens when it's not precise?
Yeah, so that's work in progress. That's where you would actually, one of the deliverables in the model is a document showing all the unanswered questions and unresolved issues, and it would be in that document. And once that's answered, then it would become precise. Yeah, so we at least identify what the issues would be.
Yeah. So if I'm a company, and I guess this is kind of a loaded question because a company could be any size and any complexity, but and I wanted to get started with data modeling, and I haven't thought about it or done it. What should I do?
I would start just by reading a book or two about the subject and see if it really excites something inside and something you wanted to pursue. There are a lot of really good books out there in modeling. We publish quite a few. I've actually written quite a few too. So,
well, yours is good. Your Data Modeling Made Simple book, I think, was fantastic. I reference it all the time in my talks. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Yeah. So that would be a good book to start. And there's also the Rose Data Stone that I wrote, which is kind of a book about the high level model. But there's also books by Graham Simsion.
And his books are so good.
Yeah. Yeah. I really enjoy his books too. So those are also good places to start. That's probably the least expensive way to see if you have that passion and you want to learn modeling. Yeah. And then attend the conference. The conferences are always a great way. You talk to other modelers and figure out where your passion lies.
That's a good one. Yeah, it's funny you mentioned Graham Simsion. His books are some of the most underrated books I've ever seen. Like they're good, and yours are awesome too. But I hold you to a sort of the pinnacles of like just teaching the core concepts of modeling. I think it's definitely inspiring and cool to see. So every chance I get, because people are like, what data modeling books should I read? I'm like, just go to Techniques, check out those books, check out Graham's books, and I think you'll be at least in a better spot than you are today. Because again, I think it's people are lost. You know, you talk mm-hmm. to the modern crop of new engineers, and they don't know where to start. So, I mean, and that's why I feel in a lot of ways, the field's going backwards, which is why I kind of jokingly say data modeling is dead in the first part of my talk. The second part is like, and you know, it's alive as well, long live data modeling. But it was it's a recognition that it, you know, throughout my work and travels and just talking to pretty much everybody, there's a whole generation where they haven't learned data modeling. I mean, they don't really know what it is or can put in how to spell data modeling if you ask them to. And so but it's a huge, huge problem. It manifests itself in all kinds of terrible ways.
Definitely. Yeah. Sometimes it takes years to see the mistakes, and that's when the pendulum swings the other way. And like you said, then you get the entropy and it goes back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, cool, man. It's good to chat with you on the show today. I really value this conversation. Learned a ton.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Anytime. The conference, this will be coming out sort of end of January, beginning of February, but what's Data Modeling Zone, Steve?
So Data Modeling Zone, a conference that what we do is we have sessions that cater to people who do data modeling. It's the only conference purely dedicated to data modeling. We have four tracks this year. Runs from February 27th to March 1st in Phoenix. And there's a track on core skills, a track on technologies like what we were talking about with AI, a track on growth, personal growth and case studies, and a track on knowledge graphs. Like you were mentioning earlier, how important knowledge graphs are to AI. Well, this is our chance to kind of get some really good training. So
that's cool.
Yeah, really, really neat. Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Joe. Really enjoyed the talk. It was fun to chat.
Yeah, likewise. Yeah. All right. Chat with you later. All right. Okay, see you at the conference.
See you at the conference. Thanks.
Yeah.